Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoplin, and here we are once again. It's amazing. Time flies.
It does.
It's time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, and I'm here with Layla Mutin, who is our nutritionist in residence. She works together with me at our practice here in Manhattan. And she, for those of you who are new listeners, she's a registered dietitian, and she also has a master's degree in the field of nutrition. So it's been, sort of a, busy week.
Yeah.
And what's in the news this week? Anything in particular that we want to talk about before we get into questions?
I think there was something in the Huffington Post.
The Huffington Puffington Post?
The Puffington Post, right. About how taking a break.
Oh, okay. I saw that.
Yeah.
I just skimmed that article. Tell me, what was that about?
I skimmed it myself, but I know the points that they're trying to make, which is the more salient points, that it may be good to take a break from your chronic low-calorie diet to reprime your metabolism a little bit. Now, this actually supports the argument that we should not be eating a stagnant amount of calories every day because Mother Nature then puts us in starvation mode, as the article also states. And that works against us eventually, because as soon as we eat a few more calories than the, 1,200, 1,400, 1,600 calories a day, we're going to gain weight. So it's best not to do a stagnant amount of
And that's more paleo too, because we were subject to times of plenty and times of famine, and there were periodic changes in the food supply.
Feast
and so
famine.
That's more physiologic. Actually, that's why maybe you want to build in a little bit of a fast or maybe a very low calorie period, and then
that's why an intermittent fast better.
IF.
Then the IF works better than every day having a long fast, a 16-hour fast like that.
And IF, intermittent fasting, is becoming a buzzword in nutrition science because it seems to reboot the metabolism as well as the immune system. It has good effects. We have anti-cancer effects and so on. So another one that I'll share with you, and I'll pose this question, is what's the worst thing in the American diet?
Trans fats?
Okay.
Man-made?
Okay. No question. And but that's actually, that's a little bit off the table because trans fats have already been fingered and they're now being kind of eradicated from the diet. So let me give you a multiple choice here.
Okay.
Fructose, and there's plentiful fructose in the U.S. diet, right? It's bad. Coconut oil or soybean oil?
Soybean oil.
Okay. Correct answer. Ding, 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 ding.
Soybean oil.
According to a study at UC Riverside, soybean oil causes more obesity than either coconut oil or fructose. And again, this is based on animal research. So, we have to, it's a step before we can generalize this to humans.
Right.
But we've always suspected that soybean oil is a problem. They said UC Riverside scientists found mice on a high soybean oil diet, not soybeans, but soybean oil, which is unnatural, and high in omega-6.
They weren't nibbling on edamame, they were...
Yes.
Yeah.
For those of you not familiar with edamame, we frequent sushi restaurants here in New York. If you're in, Wichita, Kansas, and there's not a lot of, sushi restaurants, edamame is the little appetizer they give you, green soybeans.
The soybeans,
kind of steamed, and you pop open the pods and... Now you can get them virtually anywhere. They come in, frozen. You can, steam them yourself. They found that mice on a high soybean oil diet showed increased levels of weight gain and diabetes compared to mice even with high fructose diet or high coconut oil diet. And recently, coconut oil was stigmatized, American Heart Association. They said, don't eat this saturated fat. So the scientists fed male mice a series of four diets that contained 40% fat. In one diet, the researchers used coconut oil. In the second diet, about half of the coconut oil was replaced with soybean oil. And the other two diets had added fructose, comparable to the amount consumed by many Americans who drink a lot of sodas and eat a lot of candy and have a lot of salad dressing. And it's everywhere. It's in ketchup. It's in, many things. All four diets contain the same number of calories, so there was no difference there.
Right.
Compared to the mice on the high coconut oil diet, mice on the high soybean oil diet showed increased weight gain, larger fat deposits, a fatty liver with signs of injury, diabetes and insulin resistance, which are all part of something called metabolic syndrome.
Yes.
They also had, the mice on the soybean oil enriched diet gained almost 25% more weight than the mice on the coconut oil diet with identical calories.
Yeah.
Identical calories.
Yeah.
So
let's explain that.
Yeah.
Coconut oil is used, metabolized quickly for energy.
Yeah.
So it actually helps to rev up the metabolism.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very important.
It's more utilized for energy rather than stored.
Yes, and it's a very saturated fat.
Yeah.
Soybean oil, on the other hand, has a lot of pro-inflammatory omega-6 fats. And a lot of these can also go rancid.
And inflammation actually is associated with metabolic slowdown, insulin
yes.
resistance. Now, when
and
compared
to
fructose, which we, you mm-hmm. know, fructose, which has really been stigmatized, and there's no question that we consume too much fructose, although a little fresh fruit is not so bad, as I talked about in a recent article in my newsletter. The mice on the soybean oil diet gained 9% more weight than those on the fructose-enriched diet.
Mm-hmm.
But still, the mice on the fructose-enriched diet gained 12% more weight than those on a coconut oil-rich diet.
Mm.
So they say, the paper is entitled, Soybean Oil is More Obesogenic and mm-hmm. Diabetogenic mm-hmm. than Coconut Oil and Fructose in the Mouse.
Okay.
It has something to do with liver metabolism. There's some sort of biochemistry that occurs in the liver, the way that it's transformed into a storage fat rather than energy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
Yeah. Almost want to say duh, but you know, very interesting. It's good that they really lay out the point. And we all have to reconsider our sources of soybean oil. It's everywhere.
Salad dressing. The cheap oil that's almost
yes.
invariably in salad dressing.
Yeah. They will say made with olive oil, but that
like
could be 10% olive
oil. There's a smidge.
Yeah, yeah. A smidge, a
yeah.
drop.
Yeah.
So you have to consider bottled salad dressings, mayonnaises mm-hmm. that are better quality mayonnaises made with avocado oil, made with flax oil.
Well, that's the other thing. I love mayonnaise.
Yeah.
It's all made with soybean oil. So yeah. now I get from Thrive Market, I get the
avocado mayonnaise.
Yeah. Which, so I'm not pouring soybean oil into my system,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
which was very bad. I mean, yeah. a lot of foods are sort of, you know, the Trojan horse,
mm-hmm.
you know, that infiltrated the Greeks into Troy. A lot of foods are a Trojan horse for bad stuff, like
yes.
added fructose, added sodium, added mm-hmm. Soybean oil.
And you know, we're getting a lot of that soybean oil from GMO soybeans, which is practically 100% of the crop. At this point,
that may be part of the deleterious effect of soy.
Could be.
But soy per se, whether it's organic, non-GMO, it probably mm-hmm. isn't that great to consume that much oil,
yeah.
which is very unnatural.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay, so.
Interesting stuff.
Good, yeah. Always important stories that we want to pass along to you.
Yeah.
So let's get to questions.
Okay, we've got an email from Peggy. Peggy says, I have protein shakes when I lift weights. Since I can't have whey, do you know of a good quality other protein that I could take that actually tastes
good? Why can't she have whey?
Well, she doesn't say. And
okay.
I imagine maybe she's avoiding dairy because she's allergic or she has autoimmunity.
So a lot of people tackle that for a second.
Yeah.
People who are lactose intolerant don't usually have a problem with whey because
yes.
it doesn't have lactose.
Right, right. It's
so it's more the protein part than the sugar part of the, mm-hmm. of the milk.
Yeah.
So also whey is actually just one of the proteins that's in milk. That's lactalbumin,
yes.
I believe, is in whey. And then there's casein. Now, more people who are sensitive to the effects of dairy are sensitive to the casein.
Yeah.
And sometimes people who are, quote, allergic to dairy do okay when they use whey.
Yeah.
I believe I'm among them because I can use whey,
mm-hmm.
But I don't do very well with dairy products. So, for example, I don't know, the other day, there was some cheese in the refrigerator. I didn't
uh-huh.
buy it, but it ended up there.
Uh-huh.
And I said, let me have some because I'm, you know, so good, so virtuous. I have just a little bit. It tastes great. And
uh-huh.
and then I realized why it's so addictive. It just, you know, I'm
Those casomorphins.
Oh, the aged cheese, you know, the camembert and all that. It's great.
Well, you had good stuff.
I just had a little bit. I was so congested the next morning. I just realized I cannot, can't go there.
Yeah.
So, you know, I really urge anybody who has suffered from chronic allergies, nasal congestion,
sinusitis,
all get off the dairy.
Get rid of the dairy. Really, you know, absolutely.
It's, I mean, not everybody is sensitive, but.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm sorry, we didn't get
so alternative protein sources for protein shakes for Peggy. Did you know that hemp is a complete protein?
Wow.
A lot of people are going, soy, I have to have soy because it's a complete protein. No, you don't. And especially no, you don't. If you have thyroid issues, soy will also, you know, it's not great for, it's goitrogenic. It contains some trypsin inhibitors, all
might
of that.
It might be harder to digest.
It's harder to digest.
What about egg protein?
Egg protein is a wonderful idea. Egg protein. Some people with an egg allergy may have that allergy or showing up because they get a flu shot.
What are other types of commonly available? Rice protein?
Rice protein combined with pea protein. So we get the lysine and the methionine putting together.
So you think it's just a pure rice protein is incomplete as far as the amino acid profile?
So we're doing the rice and the beans or the rice and the legume, the grain and the legume for complementary proteins.
That is...
This is back to
this goes to Francis Moore-Lepay, Diet for a Small Planet. Talked about combining proteins when you're on a vegetarian diet. She said, there's a little protein in grains, but it's incomplete.
Right.
So that's why many cultures have these dishes, which are rice and beans,
yes.
or bulgur wheat and chickpeas.
Yeah.
You know, and then it kind of, these are complementary amino acids that kind of create a more balanced amino acid spectrum.
To make sure that one is lacking lysine, the other is lacking methionine. You put them together, it's a better. It's a better amino acid lineup. So there's that. There's hemp protein, rice and pea protein, egg protein. These all may be good ideas for Peggy. And of course, Peggy, you have to do a taste test. One of the things that we have our patients and clients do, they could use water as the liquid. They could use almond milk. They could add some frozen blueberries into it, or some frozen raspberries.
And always put in a little bit of, like a tablespoon of coconut oil.
Coconut oil.
Because it gives it a nice body.
Yes.
And, you
a
know,
texture.
Yeah.
Maybe a tablespoon of nut butter, some almond butter or something like that, macadamia nut butter. You kind of have to flavor it yourself. Most of these come in chocolate, vanilla, strawberry. There's no chicken soup flavors on these or tomato and basil flavors on these.
Although
I've had some bars at conferences that were savory.
Yeah.
They were awful.
Oh,
were just awful.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's
protein
unfortunate.
Bars, yeah, you didn't really want to buy your protein bar that has
here's a tomato basil protein bar. No.
Yeah.
No.
Well, you know what? But there are these paleo bars that are meat bars. They really are.
They're like a jerky.
Yeah.
Or
yeah,
a pemmican something.
Pemmican.
Yeah.
Pemmican is the word. That's what Indians, Native Americans used.
Yeah.
For long journeys, and pemmican was, it's probably thousands and thousands of years old.
Yeah.
Where it's some dried meat along with,
dried cranberry.
Yes, with fruit, a little bit of fruit.
A little bit of fruit to flavor it, not too much.
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially it. Peggy, it may turn out that you don't need the protein shakes when you lift weights. I would say, go eat a good lunch or a good dinner.
You know, that's another, another point to be made. And, and I have to say, rarely do I feel the need to do that. Usually I eat food.
Yeah.
And it's thought that the best way to build muscle is to not have the food before,
right.
but to have the food after when you're there's a muscle debt and you're trying to replenish it.
There's like a 45-minute, 60-minute window where those branched-chain amino acids in your protein are very beneficial.
Yeah, so you don't want to do a major CrossFit workout or some heavy weightlifting and then have a fruit bowl. You know,
right.
that's not that's going to replenish your carbohydrates.
Exactly.
But it's your glycogen will
your
be
glycogen.
Replenished. But you actually want to feed the muscles because the muscles are in a repair state.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time
we need the protein for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We have another question. We've got an email about coffee enemas. I heard they're good, but can they negatively affect the gut microbiome?
Boy, are they good. Oh, God. just love those.
I've never done.
Well, full disclosure,
yeah,
I've done them.
Okay.
And the reason I did them is because I knew the late Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez.
Yes.
And he said, Ron, you have to do these coffee enemas. They're great. Uh-huh. You're going to feel great. And so I think for about a month or two, I did them every day.
Yeah, he did them every day.
Yeah. I did a morning coffee enema. And he mm-hmm. said, it has to be organic caffeinated coffee.
Yes.
And so I had my morning cup of coffee.
Not hot.
Not too hot, but warm and not,
warm.
And not ice, definitely not iced coffee.
No.
So I had my, and I would read my morning paper, retain that enema for a while.
Wow.
So the benefits are that it actually is a liver cleanser. There's some studies that show that coffee taken orally even reduces the risk of liver cancer. And maybe beneficial
detox.
For it helps you to relieve liver stasis. Mm. It is a tried and true, very traditional detoxification procedure.
Yeah,
that only fell into disfavor in the 20th century. It was done quite a lot in the past. It's the basis for his cancer treatment for a lot of patients to detox them. And
so, did Dr. Gonzalez believe then that doing the enema was more beneficial than drinking coffee?
Yes. Why? Okay. And I'll tell you why. Hmm. Because when you take coffee rectally, the blood vessels in the intestine absorb it, and it goes directly through the portal circulation to the liver. Now, it can go to the liver when you drink it orally, but it's a more slow and subtle process by which the coffee reaches the liver.
Okay.
So... Okay. So anyway, you also get these beneficial compounds. You get chlorogenic acid.
Chlorogenic acid.
Yeah, and other polyphenols, which are present in coffee, which have, they're like cocoa and resveratrol and terastilbene in wine. They're polyphenols with benefits.
Yeah.
So now the question is interesting because I don't think that it's been studied whether colonics in general or enemas disrupt the intestinal flora. But interestingly, I read an article recently about colonoscopies. And colonoscopies, you have to do a cleanse.
Yeah.
And you clean yourself
or
out.
Miralax yeah,
clean
or yourself something.
Out. And the thought is that may create transient or even long-term changes in your microbiome. Hmm. But it's unknown whether these are harmful changes or whether they're just temporary or whether there could be you could create just an imbalance. It's also thought that one of the benefits of the dark compounds that are, for example, in cocoa is not so much that they are used by your body, but they're used by your microflora and your intestinal tract to stimulate the growth of good bacteria. So it might be that there's a beneficial effect on the flora from the coffee that goes up there.
Yeah. Anything can disrupt our microbiome or change it. Just changing your diet from day one to day five, there will be a difference in your microbiome map, if you will, just from subtle changes in diet. That can happen as well. So... Okay. Wow. Coffee enemas, so popular. All right.
In some circles.
In some circles, right. Okay, we've got another question here about vitamin D. I live in the Mid-Atlantic and miss the sun during winter months. Ah, who doesn't? I know they have a bad reputation, but are tanning beds beneficial at all, even for a few minutes for getting sun exposure?
So...
I was a huge fan.
And I did it a lot around the time that you did it.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit waxing less enthusiastic about that, and perhaps because I'm older.
I started covering my face more towards the end.
Because the concern is that there is photoaging that occurs with a lot of exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's benefits in terms of the vitamin D.
Yeah.
But you can also take vitamin D orally, and you can achieve levels of vitamin D. Now, there's actually some controversy as to whether there's the same efficacy of vitamin D taken orally as vitamin D that's manufactured in your skin.
That's true too.
That there may be something, some added benefit. There's also clearly an endorphin effect of bright light.
Sunlight.
Ultraviolet and bright light in general.
And it doesn't have to do with vitamin D. It's simply the ultraviolet light and lowering cortisol.
And of interest is that they suspect that's one of the reasons why people get hooked on tanning. Is they literally, it's an opiate response. It's not an exogenous opiate.
Right.
It's your own endorphins, but it's sort of like that runner's high that you get. So it is a feel-good thing. I certainly felt good and energized, and I felt, you know, like when it was, 11 degrees outside, I'd go and strip down in a tanning parlor. And
that
I'd feel
was
like,
fun. That was
like,
good.
Yeah.
I like that.
I felt like it sort of dispelled the winter gloom.
Yeah.
So too.
And maintaining a little tan. That was nice too.
Right. Just for appearance sake.
Right. Right.
Aesthetically. But, it may be our only alternative because the Caribbean is being destroyed as we speak.
Yeah.
You know, here.
Hurricanes.
It's less of an option for some people to go to their favorite island this winter. We may have to consider trips to, South America or Arizona or California this year.
Right.
Because some of these beautiful places have been devastated.
Yeah. Our hearts go out. Wow. All right. So the tanning bed. All right. When I did the tanning bed at all, I chose the lowest
intensity.
Thank you. There was grade A, B, and C. Right. I was in booth C. And sometimes I went for the maximum amount of time, which was 8 minutes.
Right.
But then most of the time I go for half the time.
Okay.
But I might go only about 3 days a week.
Right.
So it was enough to maintain a little pink. Yeah.
Looking at you, you know, you're...
I haven't been for many years now.
Of a certain age, which I will not divulge.
Uh-huh.
No, but go ahead. No,
53,
don't.
That's fine.
No, okay,
53.
Fine. All right, if you want to rock that,
fine. Yeah, I'm rocking it.
But your skin is really in good condition. You don't show a lot of photo aging or damage from
Thank
it.
Thank you.
You've been judicious or...
That and it's hereditary too.
And But another
family.
Point that I'll make is that if you're going to be exposed to the sun... There are, and I do usually run this article sometimes at the beginning of the sun season. It's a sort of a perennial article that I can run in June about things that you can take which prevent photo aging and also have an anti-cancer effect. So among them are niacinamide.
Mm-hmm.
There is a product called HelioCare, which contains a certain plant that actually has some skin cancer and photo aging effects. It's been demonstrated. But also EGCG from green tea. I really believe that's helpful.
EGCG.
Vitamin E also. Taken internally, mixed tocopherols with rich in gamma tocopherols.
Lycopene,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Because lycopene itself is a bit of a pigment.
Right. It's almost like a self-tanner.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Although it makes it a little orange rather than...
It's not like eating up two bags of carrots and you're orange
or
something like that.
So there's a strategy for, sort of like safe sun that you want to do. And it's a little less about sunscreen than we think, and especially because certain sunscreens may give us a fool's paradise, that they actually block certain rays, but allow other rays to penetrate. Plus, their chemical constituents may penetrate the skin and have deleterious effects.
Yeah. And another drawback about tanning beds is you're getting not a whole lot of UVB the way you would in June in New York at noon.
Okay, so you're getting UVA.
You're getting some. You're getting mostly UVA. Mm-hmm. And I think at that point is when I decided, all right, you know what? Let's stop this.
Okay.
Just, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the best thing is just jump on a plane.
Hop on a plane.
Right.
Go south.
Right.
Wait for the next hurricane to pass or something, but oh yeah. Thank you for your questions.
This is a good point at which to pause because we generally divide our podcast into two parts. And in part two, give us a preview of what we're going to be talking about.
Is fulvic acid as beneficial as they say?
Oh, okay. Fulvic acid. That's a new trend we want to tackle when we return in part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman today with Layla Mutin, our nutritionist in residence. And this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.